today I would like to start the renormalization procedure, and it will be a lengthy calculation. It will take us 2.5 lectures to arrive at the final result. So, and it's not complicated, but it's lengthy. So I'll split that into several steps. But before we start doing that, I would like to, you know, tell you why we are doing this again. And so just to give you this big picture, what we are trying to achieve, and so where it fits in all the things. So the goal of all our effort is basically to understand a very particular type of phase transitions, which is the continuous phase transition. In the vicinity of the critical point, near critical point. Well, this is okay. So, of course, not every phase transition is a continuous phase transition. And so there are various types of phase transitions, and we just concentrate here on one type. So phase transitions, and so you have various types of. The most common is the first order phase transition, which is, for example, if you want to change liquid to gas or solid to liquid. So this will be first order phase transition typically. You can have then these continuous. But you can also have infinite order phase transitions, which are like topological phase transitions, which we will briefly discuss next week. You can also have glassy phase transitions, which I don't know what they are, but doesn't matter. You can have quantum phase transitions, which will be discussed by Dennis. And so quantum phase transitions, basically the characteristic feature of a quantum phase transition is that what we are doing here happens at a finite temperature. And so you have some fluctuations which are induced by finite temperature, and then you can, you know, these fluctuations can basically trigger your phase transition. So quantum phase transitions actually can happen, at t equal to zero. So even such phase transitions you can have. So now the characteristic thing for a phase transition was this introduction of order parameter. But not every phase transition which I mentioned here can be described by this order parameter. So let's call it X. And so if you can introduce an order parameter, then the phase transition corresponds to the symmetry breaking associated with this order parameter. And so there's a corresponding symmetry breaking. And so we had an example of the order parameter was the magnetization. So for example, e.g. magnetization was an order parameter. And the phase transition was associated with breaking of the Z2 symmetry. And then we will discuss continuous symmetry next week. But also, for example, if you consider a phase transition from liquid to gas, then your order parameter is the density of the liquid minus the density of the gas. So that's another example. So delta rho, which can be rho liquid, or it's better, rho gas, well, rho liquid is bigger. So rho liquid minus rho gas would be another example of an order parameter. And so if you can talk about order parameter and introduce it, then you basically distinguish the first order and the continuous phase transitions depending on whether this order parameter is continuous during the phase transition or whether it suffers from a jump. So typically, the first order phase transition looks like this. So this is your order parameter. And then you have a jump, and so this can be temperature or anything else, but there's a jump for first order. And this is continuous for a continuous phase transition. So it's continuous. So now what I was trying to tell you in tutorial is that the first order phase transitions are in fact much more common than the continuous phase transitions. The reason is that basically, in order to have continuous phase transition, you need to have some kind of symmetry, nice symmetry present in your Hamiltonian description. So generically, you will have no such symmetry describing your problem. And if you have no such symmetry, then the first order is the thing, first thing which happens. Only if you have symmetry, the first order doesn't happen, and higher order phase transition happens. Okay, so more symmetry you have, higher order phase transitions basically happen. Okay, so these occur often in nature. The reason why two phases can coexist together is that you need to provide latent heat to change one phase to another phase. If you want to change water to gas, you have to boil it. So you have to provide the heat from, and so then basically the phase transition is driven by providing this latent heat. Okay, latent heat. And if you don't provide it, then the two phases can happily coexist together. And so hence the name coexistence line and so on. So I can really have water next to gas. And if I'm not providing any heat, well, this system will stay there forever like that. Okay, so only if I start boiling the water, I change it to gas, and then the other way around. Okay, so now why we are not describing these phase transitions really is because they are difficult to describe. Well, let's put that in quotes. So of course we have this nice thermodynamic theory to describe them, and so we know that the Gibbs free energy will behave in a certain way to describe these phase transitions. But once you start actually describing these microscopically, then actually you realize that there is no universality for these first order phase transitions. So what happens is that each first order phase transition is different to another first order phase transition. So basically, you know, you have to study case by case, and there is no universality. So depend on concrete microscopics, and there is no universality. So that's why they are difficult to describe, because you have to really study case by case, and so we are not basically doing that here. So what we are doing is that we are concentrating on these continuous phase transitions, which are less often. You need to have the symmetry so that this can happen. So we need symmetry. Symmetry. But they are nice because they demonstrate this universality. So nice. They have universality. So meaning that you can introduce these critical exponents and you can classify the phase transitions into various universality classes, and you find that, you know, different systems actually behave the same way under the phase transition. Okay. And so what we really are trying to do is that we are trying to concentrate on this vicinity of the critical point and describe properly what's happening there. Okay, so critical point here. And so this critical point can be described by these critical exponents. Which describe how various physical quantities behave near this critical point. And so, for example, for our Ising model, but that can be carried, you know, to much more generally, you define these as the specific heat goes to T to minus alpha. So how much the specific heat diverges at the critical point is described by critical exponent alpha. Critical exponent beta describes how the order parameter behaves near this critical point. And you see it's small, so it's continuous, so it's T to plus beta. And the susceptibility is T to minus gamma. And the response to the magnetic field is M to delta. And then we have two more, which we introduced yesterday. We have the correlation length and the correlation function, so G of R goes like E to minus R over psi, and then it's R T minus 2 plus eta, and so eta is the anomalous dimension here, and psi goes like T to minus nu. So the correlation length psi diverges at the critical point, and this is the behavior of the spin of the correlation function. And so now you can classify various continuous phase transitions based on whether these critical exponents are the same or not. Okay. So now it seems that we have, well, alpha, beta, gamma, delta is 4, and then eta and nu. So it seems that we have like 6. Critical exponents here, exponents, but not all of them are independent. And so you will show tomorrow in your tutorial that actually there are various equalities which these critical exponents have to satisfy. So not all 6 are independent. And so they are connected by equalities, and so let me just write, so they are named by famous people. So Rushbrook, so he said that alpha plus 2 beta plus gamma is the universal number 2. So this is 2 beta. So that's one equality which these exponents have to satisfy. Then there is Griffiths. Yeah. Griffiths. And so alpha plus beta times delta plus 1 equals to 2. That's another equality. Then Fisher. So gamma equals to nu times 2 minus eta. And finally, Josephson. Alpha equals to 2 minus nu times d, where d is the number of spatial dimensions of your system. OK, so these are 4 equalities. These exponents usually satisfy. Actually, the one which has the dimension in it is not always satisfied. But for some systems, it is. Okay, so then you would have 6 minus 4 relations, so you would have only two independent critical exponents. Okay. So now, these equalities are relatively very, very general. So they can be, and you will see tomorrow in your tutorial, they can be obtained from some general scaling arguments, basically. And so they are almost always valid up to the last one. And so you expect that, in fact, really, only two, or at most three, critical exponents are independent. So now it's a prediction of the mean field theory, or Landau's theory, that we have these critical exponents, so alpha equals to 0, beta equals to 1/2, gamma equals to 1, delta equals to 3, eta equals to 0, and nu equals to 1/2. So that's it's a prediction of the mean field theory. So now, maybe they satisfy some of these relations, maybe don't. You should check yourself in your tomorrow's tutorial, and maybe today if you want to. So that's the prediction of the mean field theory. So unfortunately, it turns out that this is not really observed for many systems. So basically never observed. And so if you want to describe your Ising model, for example, in three dimensions, then your mean field theory prediction is these critical exponents for the Ising model, but it's not true. So now we have to go beyond the mean field theory description. And that's the renormalization which we are going to do to get better these critical exponents. So mean field theory predicts phase transitions correctly but gives wrong critical exponents.
That predicts phase transition correctly.
Well, okay.
Because in one dimension, it's like.
So, in one dimension, it was wrong.
Okay.
But yeah. So let's talk about three dimensions. And so then, if you are using a mean field theory, then you would predict, yeah, there is a phase transition for the Ising model, and it would predict these critical exponents for your for the behavior of your quantities. So, however, these critical exponents are wrong, and they are not. Yeah, almost correct, but not really. So we want to actually improve that a little bit. And so to get better agreement and we will use the renormalization procedure. Okay, so that's our aim, to basically get these critical exponents, but now more correctly for the Ising model in three dimensions, let's say. Okay, and so for that you'll start with the Landau-Ginzburg functional. But let me just use an opportunity here, because I just have this review of the first order phase transitions and the continuous phase transition. So this has nothing to do with the course, but let me mention it anyway. So in my research, I encountered this very nice situation in black hole physics. You can observe some phase transitions. And so I talk about transitions from small black holes to large black holes through thermodynamics last time. So let me do a different example of a phase transition. And this example will be a so-called gravitational Meissner effect. So if you are not interested in gravitational physics, just switch off. It will take only 10 minutes, I hope. So gravitational Meissner effect. But I think it's quite interesting, and it's still an open problem, what's really happening there. So, okay, so what's going on here? So Meissner effect, of course, is an effect which describes that if you have a superconductor, it expels the magnetic field as you approach, you know, in the superconducting phase, so for small temperatures. So now black holes can have temperature, and so if you can assign a temperature to the black hole, and so more extreme of the black hole is, the lower temperature it has. So you have seen in your relativity course black hole, which was described by the mass m, but you can equally start, you know, putting charge to the black hole, or you can start spinning the black hole. And so more you spin, or more you add charge, more extreme of the black hole is, and lower temperature it has. Okay, so there is this, so extremal black holes. Extremal black holes. And so, is there enough space? Maybe. So I can have a black hole which has mass, but now it has also a charge. And then if this charge is equal to m, you will call the black hole extremal, and it will have exactly zero temperature. Okay. So similarly, you can consider a rotating black hole, and so the rotation will be described by the rotation parameter A, and if these two are equal, then you will again say that the black hole is maximally spinning, is spinning as fast as it can. Okay?
And David, in that case, when we see that they have temperature zero,
so
like the entropy of black hole.
So the entropy is non-zero.
It's
non-zero, but the temperature is equal to zero. And I'll talk about this a little bit more next week, but it's, at this point it's not very, very important for us. So now what was observed in basically 60s or 70s is that there's this gravitational Meissner effect. So you can, you know, try to put a black hole into the magnetic field. So I make a theoretical experiment. I'm putting a black hole in a uniform magnetic field, perhaps produced by the, you know, surrounding plasma, which is of course charged, and you know it can carry some magnetic fields. So now what happens in the extremal case is that the magnetic field actually goes around. It never penetrates the black hole. So it actually behaves like this. Based like that, and then it becomes more and more uniform. And so this is my B. And so very, very far away from the black hole, it will be just uniform magnetic field. But it, as your field lines are getting closer and closer to the black hole, they will just all go around, and they will never penetrate the black hole.
And so are Einstein equations solvable exactly in this case, or?
So, you can do it exactly, yes, yes, yes. You would be solving Maxwell equations plus Einstein equations, and then you would have exact solution which actually expels the magnetic field. Okay, and the same thing happens in the case of the rotating black hole. So if you are putting a black hole which is extremal into the magnetic field, the field lines are expelled from the black hole. And so because, you know, there was this analogy with superconductor, people thought maybe there's some, you know, connection with superconductivity, and they call this effect gravitational Meissner effect. Okay, so now, so far, no phase transition. Yes?
So, just a quick question. If you put a charge or a current inside the black hole,
So here, yes, I have a charge here inside the black hole. Well, that's basically it. I cannot really put like currents inside, but I can have my black hole charged.
I don't really understand how all of the magnetic field can go around, because like what happens to the line that goes directly down the middle?
Well, I don't know what happens with the line which goes directly in the middle, but if you take anything, you know, away from it, you can show that there's zero flux going through the black hole, through the horizon.
It just seems like that solution would be like the field would be discontinuous at the poles there.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I don't know, but if you go anywhere else, it's simply expelled, and you can show that if you, you know, calculate how much flux of magnetic field goes through this horizon, it's zero. You can show that. So maybe there's something, you know, going through the North Pole, but it doesn't really contribute. Okay.
It also works for Trimont-Kerr-Niemann.
Basically for any extreme black hole. Okay, so. So now, why I'm mentioning these two cases, because they seem to differ with what I'm going to discuss now. So now, you can think about not putting a black hole in the magnetic field, but you can think about penetrating your black hole with a cosmic string. So now, what is a cosmic string? So cosmic string cosmic string is basically like a topological defect which could have been created. Nobody observed any cosmic string so far. Too bad for string theory. But so it's a topological defect which could have been created, you know, in the early universe when you had so much energies and, you know, close to hot Big Bang. You could have created these cosmic strings. So what is a cosmic string? So the simplest model of a cosmic string is you have like two cores. So one core is precisely formed of the magnetic field. So you have sort of like a magnetic field going through one core, and then you can assign a radius to this magnetic field and call it RB. And then you also need to hold this together. And for that, you need also other quantity, let's say a scalar field. And that can have a different radius. Let's call it R phi. So basically you have like a self-gravitating thing of a flux tube of magnetic field, and then you have some scalar field holding it together in some sense. So that's what your cosmic string is. Of course, both these fields sort of, you know, go all the way to infinity but decay very quickly. So if you draw the profile of these fields, then the scalar field, for example, goes like this, and so you would say this is my R phi. So this is phi, and this is the radius, how far you are from the center. And so you would say, yeah, so this field is almost, you know, constant and not interesting after this radius, but it changes rapidly within this radius, okay? So it's actually the value of the field increases from zero to some constant value as you go from here to there. And similarly, the magnetic field would decay very quickly. Let's say like that, so you would say this is my R of B or whatever. Okay, so anyway, so just, you know, what you need to know is that you have the string, and that string is composed of magnetic field, which goes like that, and then you have some scalar field, which goes there. Okay, so that's the setup. And so now you may be interested, you know, what's happening with this string if you try to penetrate the black hole.
Like what, when you take the topological defect, in what thing is it?
So it's basically like a Aharonov bomb effect. So you have some kind of non-trivial magnetic field, you know, confined to some region, and it has some effect on the things which go around this. So what you can show is that if you have this configuration that, for example, you create some defect in your spacetime, you cut some angle around your string. And so instead of, you know, going around your string, you don't have 2 pi, but you have 2 pi minus something.
Okay.
Yeah, so in that sense, it's a topological defect. So now you can study, you know, what happens when you try to put a string through this black hole. And so what you find is very, very interesting. So if you have a thin string, so if these radii, you know, then the string actually, even in the extremal case, it just goes through this black hole, even in the extremal case of charged or rotating case. But if you have, so this is a thin string. However, if you have a bigger string, meaning that the radius is actually bigger, then suddenly you see the same expulsion as you did before. Okay, so this is a thick string. What do I mean by thin or thick is, of course, when you compare to the radius of the black hole. So if the radius of the string, let's say R phi, is, you know, big with respect to the radius of the black hole, you know, this thing happens. So expulsion happens of all the fields. And if it's, you know, much smaller than the size of the black hole, then a penetration happens. Okay. So now, of course, you can plot, you know, what, so you can start increasing the radius of the string with respect to the radius of the black hole. And at some point, you have to undergo a phase transition from penetration to expulsion. Okay, and so, interestingly, so what we claim in the paper with Ruth Gregory, which may not be true, is that if I talk about the value of the scalar field, let's say here, so I have phi and pi half, And I call that an order parameter eta. So in this case, the scalar field will be, you know, pretty much equal to that constant value. If I start increasing the radius of the string, the value of phi will decrease, okay? Because I am now closer to that thing. So anyway, so you can plot now this value of the field as a function of this ratio of the radius of the string with respect to the radius of the black hole. And so what you observe is these two different graphs. So for the charge case, this is your order parameter, and this is your r phi over r plus. R plus is the horizon radius, and you observe a nice second order phase transition. So if the string is you know thin, then you have the penetration and the field actually is non-trivial on the horizon, and suddenly if the radius is too big, the scalar field doesn't penetrate the black hole, just goes around and the value is zero. Okay, so this is a nice second order phase transition, and this is in the charge case. So now in the rotating case, we found that similar picture is valid, but either our numerics is wrong, or what we actually observe is this thing. So maybe in the rotating case, actually, you see a first order phase transition between penetration and expulsion of the string. So I don't know if this is true. It may be just the case of that the numerics are wrong. But if it's not, it may be another example of the fact that when you are saying, well, if I have more symmetry, which means in the charge case, actually, my black hole is still spherically symmetric, then I see a second order phase transition. If I have less symmetry, I lose, you know, the spherical symmetry, I have rotating black hole, so now everything is, you know, less symmetric, I see a first order phase transition. So anyway, all these things are obtained numerically, so we don't have any critical exponents, we don't have anything else, so if you wanted to study numerically these things, and, you know, calculate critical exponents for these things, it will be interesting, I think, to do. Yeah?
Doesn't, in both cases, the fact that you have a string there break the spherical symmetry? Like the problem is just cylindrically symmetric.
It's a very good point. So okay, so what I'm telling you here is I'm cheating. So whereas those results are exact results. So really you solve, you know, consistently Maxwell equations plus gravitational field equations plus Einstein equations. So here we treat it in a test field approximation, meaning that we say that the presence of the string has no effect on the background geometry. So we are not consistent here, and in that sense, we are not breaking the symmetry of the black hole. So we are keeping the same black hole, but you know, just treating as test fields on that space time. Yeah. So we are not. Yeah. So perhaps more symmetry here, but I don't know. So anyway, I think this is an interesting example that you can have. You know, interesting phase transitions which go far beyond statistical physics and which are still not explained, and where you can, you know, maybe you can see really how a first order is related to the second order and so on. Okay, so I just wanted to mention this. Sorry for the interruption, and now let's go ahead and do the renormalization procedure. D, Wilsonian renormalization. And as I said, the calculation will probably last till Friday, so we'll do it in small steps. So we started with the Ising model, and then we did this Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation. And then we took a continuum limit. And so in the end, our partition function is described by Z as an integral. It looks like a functional integral over all possible fields e to minus s of phi, where this s of phi is the Landau-Ginzburg functional. And it's given by an integral d dx 1 half nabla phi square. And then we had a coupling r half phi square. And then we have coupling u over 4 factorial phi to the 4. Okay, and so this is Landau-Ginzburg. And so we basically transformed our problem of calculating this partition function to a sort of field theoretic problem. So we have classical field theory here, and described by this field phi, and this is nothing else than phi to the 4 field theory. So the only difference is that here, this nabla actually doesn't know about Minkowski time. Everything is in spatial dimensions. So D here is really spatial dimensions. Spatial dimensions. So there is no time here. So in some sense, you can think about this as a field theory living in the Euclidean space. Or, as I formulated yesterday, that you have imaginary time. So what I meant by that is simply all these things have plus sign here. There's no minus sign for time. Okay, so now if you look at the first two terms, then they give you S0. And so S0 looks like a massive Klein-Gordon field where this mass is related to this constant R, the coupling constant R. And so the last term will give you the S interacting part of this functional. So now what you can say is that, well, you remember that this R was proportional to T, so it will change sign as you cross the critical temperature. And then this U must be positive, and it came from the derivation, but at the same time you need to have well-defined Landau's functional. So now if you didn't have this thing here, and you called phi equal to eta, this is just Landau's thing, and you know everything about it. So now is the improvement is that you allow this order parameter to fluctuate from place to place. Okay? So now you can do the dimensional analysis of these things, and so it will tell you that if you are interested in three-dimensional theory, actually, there are no more terms you can add here. If you start adding more terms, let's say phi to the 6th term, they will all be irrelevant, meaning that the dimension of the corresponding coupling will be smaller than 0. Okay, so this is the most general form you can actually write down for the three-dimensional theory. Okay, so just remind you that the dimensions of R is 2, so this is definitely a relevant coupling, and that the dimension of U is epsilon, which is 4 minus D. Okay, so what we will be basically doing now is a small epsilon expansion of this thing. So our aim is to say something about three-dimensional theory, but we will do that in a sneaky way by saying this epsilon here is small. So why you are choosing 4 minus d is because this guy is the upper critical dimension, which I still haven't shown anything about it, but I'm saying that the mean field theory is exact in d equal to 4 dimensions, and so we are basically doing an expansion around this upper critical dimension. And so eventually we want, let's say, d equal to 3, or we can maybe push a little bit the results to d equal to 2, but not really. Okay? It's like doing string theory, right? You are taking large an expansion, and you know that n equal to 3 is already large. Okay? So here we are doing small epsilon expansion, but epsilon actually is 1 or 2. Questions? No?
Yeah, well, what does it mean to make an expansion in the dimensionality?
Okay, yeah. Well, you will see explicitly what we are doing.
Okay.
Yeah. So we are not really, you know, we will not be expanding in, well, we will be expanding small epsilon. You will see. You will see.
All right.
Okay. So now the idea of renormalization is to do this integral basically step by step. So some renormalization. Normalization means do the Z integral step by step. So what I mean by that, so you can expand your field phi in the momentum space. So writing your phi of x to be a an integral of td k 2 pi to power t phi of k and then e to I k times x. So now, of course, in principle, the integral should go from 0 to infinity. Okay, then you know that your Fourier expansion is right. Okay, so now there is a problem here. So if I put here 0, well, you probably already know that, you know, close to, for small k, you have infrared divergences, and for large k, you have ultraviolet divergences. Okay, so now, if you are doing statistical physics, you have only one kind of them. So you know that the momentum cannot be too big because you have the lattice spacing A, and there is no meaning to say I have distances smaller than the lattice spacing A. So that translates to a cutoff for your momentum. So there is an upper cutoff for the momentum lambda, which is proportional to 1 over A. So this lambda proportional 1 over A, where A is the lattice spacing, is the natural cutoff. Because you have underlying lattice here. So by the way, if you are doing field theory, you introduce this cutoff anyway, right? But then you say, well, okay, I introduced this cutoff in order to calculate things, and then maybe the result is independent of the cutoff or whatever. But of course, the question is there really a natural cutoff as in the statistical physics? So is there a minimum length the spacetime can be divided to? Okay, so is spacetime really continuous, or is there a minimum length? And so, of course, the ultimate answer must be provided by quantum gravity theory, right? And so for example, if you take predictions of loop quantum gravity, they tell you there is a minimal volume of space, and it doesn't make sense to divide space to smaller volumes. So that is that cutoff in loop quantum gravity. Similarly, in string theory, you have this t-duality, and you say the string actually is dual to whatever happens on the radius r as whatever happens to alpha over r. And so that is, again, a minimal thing you can think about. So it seems that actually quantum gravity provides some natural cutoff for this guy here as well. But if you say standard quantum field theory, it has no natural cutoff. Okay, so, you know, may exist for spacetime as well. Of course, the difficulty is how to do this, you know, without breaking Lorentz symmetry and stuff like that. So can you do these things? But anyway, so this lambda is very natural if you have a lattice. Okay, so we have this high momentum cutoff. And so all we have to do is to deal with these infrared divergences. So deal with infrared divergences. And so the way how we deal that, we deal with these things, is that we never do this integral, actually, from 0 to lambda. Instead, we split it into two halves. So to avoid the problem, you split your integral from 0 to lambda to an integral from 0 to lambda over b, and then integral from lambda over b to lambda, where you have chosen b to be, let's say, slightly bigger than 1. Okay? So you split your integral from 0 to lambda into two things, and so you call this part slow modes, meaning that the momentum is slow, is small, and these things you can call fast modes. So now the trick is to do only the integral over the fast modes and never do the integral over the slow modes. And that's how you avoid the problem of infrared divergences. Okay, so it's a very clever way, right? If you see a problem, you just avoid it and you never do it. Okay, so how does that work in practice? So basically, you split your field into two parts, into phi small and phi fast, where your phi slow of k is given by phi of k, or it's equal to 0, provided that k is in this range or in the other range. K is bigger than lambda over b, and so these are the slow modes. And the fast modes are defined precisely the opposite way, so phi bigger than k is 0, or phi of k, and 0 is smaller than k, smaller than lambda over b, and k is bigger than lambda over b. And these are the fast modes. And so the idea is to do the integral over fast only. Okay, so that's the idea of renormalization.
But is there any argument to say that the integral slow modes is little, or just to feel a little bit more comfortable?
That it at least to?
At least to feel a little bit more comfortable with just forgetting that part. Maybe, how do we know it's not 50% of the value, for example?
Oh, very good. So you will do it in a clever way. You will see.
Okay.
So we will be basically doing it, but without doing it. Okay, so let's see how that works. Okay. We have our functional, and we know that it splits into two parts, into the S0, S, and the interacting part. And so if you write down what S0 of phi is, well, it's 1/2 ddx, 1/2, well, it's not 1/2 now, lambda phi square plus r phi square. So that's what your S0 is by definition. You can write it in the momentum space, But because your field is weak, so basically you can, so there's always, this is quadratic in phi. So in principle, you transform to Fourier space every phi. So you get integral over k1 and then integral over k2. But then you can do the integral over ddx. And that integral over ddx basically tells you that k1 equals to minus k2. Okay, so if you do the Fourier transform and kill, you know, one of the integrals over k, by the integral over x, this is what you get. So it's phi, and then k square, and then r plus k square. Okay, so by absolute value of phi of k, I mean phi of k times phi of minus k. And the field is real, so that's why this is true. So now if you look at this thing here, and what you are trying to do is that you are trying to use this, that the phi can be split into two parts, into the slow part and into the fast part, meaning that the argument of k of phi, the k argument, is either small or big. But here, both of them are the same. So you have two fields, but they have the same k. Okay, so that means that I cannot have, so if I plug here phi small and phi slow and phi fast, and times phi slow and phi large, there will never be a product term, because that would mean that one momentum has to be small and the other one has to be fast. But that cannot happen because they are the same. Okay, so this naturally splits into a zero of phi small plus a zero of phi fast. Okay, there cannot be a product term because that would mean that the momentum, you would be one momentum slow and one momentum fast, but this can never happen because they are the same. Okay, so this thing, S0, nicely splits into S0 of slow and S0 of fast. Of course, for the interacting Hamiltonian, the interacting action, this will not be true. So S interaction of phi, which is u over 4 factorial ddx phi to the 4. Okay, so now if you are going to k space, you have 4 integrals over k. Okay, so now we can kill one of them by doing the integral over x, and that will produce a delta function, which is delta function of k1 plus k2 plus k3 plus k4. Okay, so what this is equal to is u over 4 factorial. Now you have 4 integrals, dk1, dk4, and then 2 pi d 2 pi d, and then we have phi k1 phi k4, and then the integral over x just gives you 2 pi d delta k1 plus k2 plus k3 plus k4. Is this clear? Okay. Very good. So this is how our interaction Hamiltonian looks like. But now, of course, if I plug for phi smaller and bigger for this guy and here small and bigger, then now I will have some cross terms because I have different k's here. And I can have some k1 may be small, k2 may be large, and so on. So I will have cross terms now. So this thing actually doesn't split into a sum of S interacting of slow and S interacting of fast, but it will be some bigger mess. Okay, so let's just write it as S interacting of phi slow and phi large, but it doesn't, you know, split into a sum of two separate terms. Okay, so now what we want to do is precisely we want to integrate only over the fast mode. So when we are calculating our partition function, we want to integrate only over this guy here and leave that integral for later. Okay, so your set, which is now of course written as d phi slow and d phi fast, e to minus s pi slow and, well, of that. So now, after the integration over the fast modes, what remains is an integral over the slow modes. And then there will be some new action, some new effective action, which will depend only on phi slow. OK, so this is what happens after you integrate the fast modes out. So after integrating fast modes. OK, so this must be the case, right? After you integrate the fast modes, I'm just left with the slow ones. So now, the crucial thing is that what you can basically say what this S tilde must look like. And the reason why you can say how this S tilde looks like is basically that your Landau-Ginzburg functional is forced upon you by the symmetry and by relevance or irrelevance. But there cannot be anything else you can write down. So basically, this S tilde must have exactly the same form as S. But the only thing which can change is the coupling constants, right? So I cannot write anything else, because even if I generate some new higher terms, they will be irrelevant. So the only thing that matters is only those three terms. And so I must have those three terms in S tilde. Okay, so we must have S tilde, which is now a function of slow modes, is an integral. Well, I'm writing it in the case space, but it doesn't matter. So now I'm integrating, because these are the slow modes, they only live in the range from 0 to lambda over b. OK, so ddk, and that will be the first term here. So 2 pi to power d phi slow k square. And then I can have a different coupling. So r2 k square plus r0. So that's my non-interacting thing. That's my s0. So the only thing which I did change is that now the integration doesn't go from 0 to lambda, but it only goes through the slow modes, so only to lambda over b. And now I say, well, before I had k square and I had r. But now, you know, there may be some coefficient which changes before this k square. So there may be something which is generated on this way as you integrate over the fast modes. And similarly, I can change this r to r tilde, r0 tilde. OK, and then the other term, 4 tilde over 4 factorial. So I'm changing this u to r4 tilde. And again, 0 to lambda over b. And then you have the four integrals as we have here. So dk1, ddk4, 2 pi to 4d, and then phi slow k1, phi slow k4. And then the delta function is still there, 2 pi power d delta k1 plus k4. OK, so this simply is the only possibility how your action tilde has to look like. Because all the other terms, which could be in principle there, will be irrelevant, and they don't matter. So the only thing that can actually happen is that these constants are different, that these coupling constants are different. OK, so now we will see this explicitly, by the way. So we will explicitly construct what this r4 tilde is, what this r2 tilde is, what this r0 tilde is. So you will explicitly see that this is actually true. Okay. So even if you don't believe that, yeah, it is the only possibility I can have, yes, you can show it explicitly that it really happens. Okay. So now the next step is to say, well, this action is nice. It almost looks like that one, that action, but it's not really that action, because I have different integration limits. I have from 0 to lambda over b. But I want to change it into 0 to lambda so that I can compare with the old action. Okay, so now the next step is to bring this, bring to the exactly the same, same form as the old action. And so for that, of course, I need to, if I have k which goes from 0 to lambda over b, and I want k which goes from 0 to lambda, I just, you know, multiply k by b. So you introduce new k tilde, which is this k here times b, and then surprise, I'll get an integral from 0 to lambda. Okay, so that's one thing which you have to do, but that's actually not enough. If you just changed k, you wouldn't be able to write it in the same form as above. So you also have to do is that you have to renormalize the wave function, the field. And so you introduce new phi tilde k tilde by, this is my phi slow of k, and divide it by z. And so you will find what this hat has to be so that we get exactly the same form. So this is what you need to do. The second thing is called wave function renormalization. Of course, we don't have any wave function here. You have just a classical field. But as the terminology, renormalization. So you will determine what the set has to be here. OK? Yeah?
Isn't phi slow of k 0 for k larger than lambda over b? Like, can't you just extend the limit without changing the?
Oh, well, here, that's a good point. Phi slow. Well, you could call this phi, well, if I keep phi slow, yeah, then you're right. But I in some sense want to pretend that I have new phi, which lives in this whole range, and it's non-trivial even in that range, lambda over b to lambda. But you're right, so if I had just phi slow, I could say I am integrating from 0 to lambda. But I'm like formally doing, you know, something slightly different. It's a good point. Okay, so now if you do this, so what happens? So your s tilde of phi tilde now, okay, so it becomes 1/2 an integral from 0 to lambda and d dk over 2 pi d. Okay, so now, okay, so I have this k squared term. So I'll be picking up some factors of b. So first of all, from the measure, I have b to minus d. So b minus d comes from the fact that I'm changing this d dk to d d tilde. Well, it's a tilde here. B to minus d. Okay. Then I have that coupling constant r2 tilde, which is still there. Then I have k tilde square. K tilde square. But of course, changing k to k tilde, I pick up b minus 2. Okay, so I'll have b minus 2. And then I have also the wave function phi. And I'm changing, so I'm multiplying by z for each function of phi. So I'll have z square here. Okay, so that's the first term. Now the second term will have, again, b to minus d from the measure. Then I'll have r0 tilde, and then I'll have z square from okay, so that's the first term. Everybody happy? Okay, so now the second term. Okay, so I'll have r4 tilde, and there's 1 over 4 factorial here. And then for each k, I have b to minus d, but I have now 4 k's, so it's b to minus 4d. B to minus 4d here, just coming from the measure. And then I have four phis. Each of them gives me z, so I have z to the 4. Z to the 4. And then the integral will be 0 to lambda, and you know, dd k1, k4, and so on. And it's exactly the same way as it was, but now in terms of phi tilde and then k tilde. Okay. So the only thing which actually changes is this thing here. Everybody happy so far? Everybody with me? Okay. So now what you want to do is you want to do a small trick. So you say that R2 tilde, whatever that is, you just parameterize that as B to some power. So B is bigger than 1. And by choosing eta, I can always.
Do we have also contribution for the delta function?
Don't you have?
Contribution from the delta?
Ah, yes, you do. Did I omit that? Yeah, I omit that. Very, very good. Thank you so much. Yeah, absolutely right. So if you are doing the transformation, so what I did here wrong, so I said R4 tilde is here, B to minus 4D comes from the measure DDK1 to DDK4, this Z to the 4 comes from phi K1 to phi K4, but there's also this delta function. So now what you need to do is that if you remember from then, that if you have delta function of x, then this is delta of x minus xi, where these are the roots, and then f prime and xi or something like that. So that's the formula how to deal with distributions if you are changing variables, basically. So what it actually gives you, the delta function gives you one more b to the d here, b to the d, and then you have the same thing. So thank you so much for that. That's crucial. That's crucial.
There are also a lot of tildes missing, right?
And there's lots of tildes here. Yeah. Here I have all the tildes here.
Yeah, but in the phi tilde, t
tilde. Yeah, here. Yeah. Everything there is tilde. Okay, so now, first thing you can do is that you say R2 tilde can be always expressed as B to some appropriate power. Well, I can get anything if I choose appropriate power eta. Okay, so this eta is called anomalous dimension. It should ring the bell. It will turn out to be exactly the same anomalous dimension as when we studied the critical exponents. And the critical exponent which appears in this correlation function will be the same eta. But at this point, it's just something which I have to tune so that I get the right R2 tilde. Okay. So then the next thing to do, so we dealt with R2 tilde, is you want your coefficient, so you want your field to be, you know, properly normalized, meaning that the kinetic term has always a value 1/2. Okay, so this k tilde square, you know, that's something which in the position space gives you nabla phi square, and you always want that coupling constant to be equal to 1/2. You don't want to change it, so you have to impose that whatever stands in front of k tilde square has to be equal to 1. Okay, so if you do that, then you get a condition that 1 is equal to b to minus t, r2 tilde is b to power eta, then we have b minus 2, and then we have z square, and so this must be equal to 1. So from here, you read that z, that factor which we had to renormalize our field, is actually b to d minus 2 plus eta over 2. So this is what you learn from the fact that you require that your kinetic term still is the standard kinetic term of your field. I have plus 2 minus eta. Is that correct? So I have d plus 2 minus eta seems good to me. D plus 2 minus eta, yeah, from here. Okay, very good. So now we know what the Z is, so that the kinetic term is properly normalized. So now we can find, so we call this thing to be my new R tilde. So before, this was equal to R, so now let's call it R tilde. And so in the same way, this guy before was called U, so let's call it U tilde. So we are getting a relation what this R tilde and U tilde is in terms of these things. So you find that R tilde is B minus D R0 tilde Z square. And if you plug for Z what this guy is, you find that this R tilde is B 2 minus eta R0 tilde. And then U tilde is that expression, so it's R4 tilde B minus 4D plus D, and then Z to the 4. And that's B to 4 minus 2 eta minus D R4 tilde. Okay? So these are the expressions which we will use later on. So these are important expressions. So U tilde is this thing, and R tilde is that thing.
And that 2 minus D there. B to the
2
minus D.
Sorry?
Like for R tilde, isn't that B to the 2 minus D?
For R tilde is 2 minus...
Oh.
Do I have a mistake there? So Z square is D plus 2 minus eta.
Never mind.
Is it correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So this is how you find the new coupling R tilde and the new coupling U tilde. So that your action looks exactly the same way as it did originally after we integrated over the fast modes. Okay? So what we are effectively doing is that the integration of the fast modes does nothing else for your action. Then it changes your coupling constants R and U to some new coupling constants R tilde and U tilde. So effectively, our integration over the fast modes actually just changed R and U, which were the coupling constants which we started with, to some new coupling constants R U tilde and U tilde, which are given over there. Okay? So this was after one step we have done. Okay, so we have split it, the integration from 0 to lambda into 0 to lambda over b and lambda over b to lambda. And we did the second integral. And then we, you know, transform it in the same type of integral as we started with. And this is what we did. So now we repeat the procedure. With the leftover integral, we again split it into lambda 0 to lambda over b, lambda over b to lambda, and do it again. Do it again, infinitely many times, as long as we need, until we find a fixed point. Okay, so do this repeatedly. Until you find a fixed point, we find a fixed point. What do you mean by a fixed point? So a fixed point is such a point that if I do this operation, integrating over fast modes, I don't change the value of the coupling. The value of the coupling remains the same. So this will correspond to some R star U star, which is some particular value of these couplings R and U, so that actually if I do this thing, it just gives me the same thing. Okay, so that this remains fixed. So R star, U star, and I do the operation, this, and I get the same thing here. So this is the definition of the fixed point, basically. Okay.
It's something related to that. To scale invariance or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Very good. So now why I'm interested in this, in the fixed point, is precisely what you are saying. So why fixed point is interesting? And so the reason is that, you know, during each operation here, we are basically changing the length scale, right? So we are multiplying the momenta by this b, which means that we are dividing the length by b. Okay, so in each step, your length scale gets divided. So if you have psi, which is my correlation length, and that was a function of my coupling constants, r and u, so then after each step, you get a new correlation length, which is basically, because it's just a length scale, it must be divided by b. Okay, so this is what we are doing. We are changing momenta by multiplying them by b. So the length scale, which is the dual, must be divided by b. Okay, so this is what's happening, is your correlation length. However, if you are at a fixed point, so at fixed point, what happens is that your psi must be equal to psi over b. Okay? So you get a new psi, which is psi over b, but it's the same psi because the couplings do not change. So psi must remain the same. So how is this possible that you have something equal to something over b where b is bigger than 1? So how that can happen? You have only two possibilities. You have either, what is the first possibility?
Zero.
Zero, exactly. So psi is equal to zero or infinity. That's the only two possibilities you can have so that this is true. So now what we will show is that if psi, well, of course, you know that the correlation length diverges exactly at the critical point. So the second thing is interesting, and you are exactly at the critical point. The first thing is that you flow to basically, you know, to a phase very, very far away from the critical temperature. So this thing corresponds to the phase. So T is not equal to T critical, and this thing corresponds to the critical point. Critical point where T equals to T critical. Okay. And so, yeah. So basically, the procedure is really now what you'll be doing is that you'll have to do explicitly this integration over the fast modes. Okay, so you will do explicitly the integration of the fast modes, which means you'll find this, what is this R0 tilde, what is this R4 tilde, and so on. And then from there, you'll find what is this guy and what is that guy. And then you will do it repeatedly. You'll find some relation how R and U are related to R tilde and U tilde. And perhaps you'll be able to find a fixed point. And once we have the fixed point, we will have, you know, and such a fixed point where psi goes to infinity, that's our critical point. So that will be the procedure for tomorrow.
Yeah, you say that for zero, that's a phase. What exactly do you mean by a phase? Just that it runs like the boundary of U, of R U space?
Well, if you remember that picture which I tried to draw last time, yesterday, so this was how the correlation length depends on temperature. So you would have, you know, somewhere here you have phase two, and then here you have phase one. Phase one. So now, you know, I know that at T critical, the correlation length sort of diverges, and the psi will be zero if I'm deeply in that phase two, or if I'm deeply in that phase one, in some sense. So it's precisely that coarse grating which you saw in this RT, it was the other page of your handout. So you see that if you zoom out of the system, and if you are, let's say, below T critical, and then you are replacing four spins by one, and four spins by one, and four spins by one, you are flowing effectively to T equal to zero configuration, to really the phase thing, right? So this is precisely what's happening here. Other questions?
R0 tilde and R4 tilde, how are they determined? Because
they should be here. So we started with, you know, RS.
Yeah.
And then I said, okay, so let's define my new S tilde by doing this functional integral over the fast modes.
Yeah.
That's how the S tilde is defined.
Yeah.
So now I said, okay, so this S tilde, however, must have the same form. The only thing which can change is the coupling constants. Okay, so I introduced these coupling constants. It was this R2 tilde and R0 tilde. And R4 tilde, and I said, you know, whatever they are, it must be of this form, and so you must get that.
But I can calculate it.
Okay, so now we will calculate them, actually. So we will really do this integral over the fast modes, and we will explicitly calculate what these guys are. So once you have those, once you have what this R2 tilde, R0 tilde, and R4 tilde is, then you get your new coupling constants by these relations here.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay, let me stop here and let's continue this calculation tomorrow.
How do you determine eta?
So I just defined eta here. I just said this R2 tilde, whatever that is, I will calculate explicitly what it is, but I define it to be to eta, so eta is defined in this way.
Okay. Okay, so both R tilde and U tilde are defined by what you get after the
interval. Yeah. So these guys I explicitly calculate, and this one I explicitly calculate tomorrow for you, and then you find what this R tilde is from this expression, and you find what U tilde is from.
You think the arbitrary?
You will see. You will see. I will basically take b equal to 1. So I'll, you will see tomorrow. I'll get some differential equations for these things.